Well, it's time to take a look at the world of insects. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on WPR. Entomologist Phil Pelletieri is back with us. He is a distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison, retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab in 2014, but still comes by once in a while to talk with us, and I hope you'll join in with your questions. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. And you can email photos as well if you've got an insect you want to have identified, or maybe show some damage to a plant or whatever. Send that photo to talk@WPR.org. Phil Pelletieri, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
All right, Larry, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, but I tell you, I was watching, it was one of the national TV news shows, and they were doing a report on cicadas, might have been in Georgia or someplace other than here, and people seem to be going absolutely nuts because of the sound, but we haven't had that yet in Wisconsin, or maybe we won't get it. What do you think?
It's going to be real spotty. You know, the one thing I'm disappointed sometimes is they don't clarify that you got to be at the right place at the right time. And like in Madison, we're not going to see it. I was outdoors this last week along the Wisconsin River where there is some activity. But if you want to get dramatic, I go to Lake Geneva, and it's going to be a good couple weeks away before it gets there. But if you are there, you kind of wonder how the residents can put up with, you know, 4 or 5 weeks of noise and critters and whatnot, because I tease people, but it's like a science fiction movie if you're in the right spot.
I'm telling you, they were interviewing people, and their eyes were haunted, and they, you know, it's like a never-ending chainsaw sound 24/7.
Yeah, I had taken my wife down to Lake Geneva and some of our neighbors the last time they went through, and my wife reported that the ringing in her ears took 2 days to go away.
Oh, man. So we deal with the 13-year cicadas, right?
Or no, we have the 17-year
17-year is the one we
The 13
have.
Is more southern, and it's a much broader area. And, of course, the interesting thing this year is there's an overlap between the 17 and the 13, especially in Illinois and a couple other areas. But it's not a big geographic area that has the overlap.
And they don't – how long do they – well, they come above ground, they feed, they mate, they lay their eggs. That's basically it. But how long does that whole process last?
Really, it's only about 4 weeks. You know, it takes them a little time to kind of mature before the singing really takes off. And then, of course, they have to find mates, and the female have to get ready. And they have a very interesting way of slicing their eggs into twigs, and you will get what we call flagging, where the tips of branches will brown out. And when those fall down, that's how the eggs get to the ground, and then the critters go on their 17-year cycle.
Mm. You know, UW-Madison entomologist P.J. Leash recently created a website about Wisconsin cicadas, and I guess the public's encouraged to report those sightings of cicadas and submit photos. And why is that information useful or important?
Well, again, to give you some historical reference, I mean, they're not going to show up in places they haven't been before. And it is interesting to document. I think generally we would say because of land use and whatnot, the areas that they cover are shrinking. But I was amazed. You know, this is the third time in my professional career I've been through this. But last time through, again, I spent a lot of time just outside of Avoca. I got out there about the second week of June, and was amazed how much activity was there that I wasn't even aware of. Oh. And that's why I said, you know, back in the last episode, from Mazamani westward along the Wisconsin River Valley, there was a moderate amount of activity.
Before we go to the phones, I want to mention ticks and tick collecting, because I know Wisconsin researchers are asking the public to help them study ticks. The Marshfield Clinic Research Institute is asking state residents who find ticks to mail them in. Mm-hmm. And what are they hoping to learn about the ticks they receive?
Well, You know, there are a number of diseases, and, you know, some are very well known, some not so much. And, you know, what ticks can do is take animal diseases, especially from mice and rodents, and transmit them. And so, you know, during my career, we went from no deer ticks in the state, or what we technically call the black-legged tick, to aside from them covering the whole state, we find out about 7 or 8 different diseases that they are capable of transmitting to humans. And the more you study, the more you find out. So it really is, I think, good to monitor this so we can get a better handle on it.
I think it was interesting that tick inventory via citizen science, I guess you could say, or TICS projects, TICS, I believe it is, TICS project, started in March. And as of last week, the researchers had received and identified over 600 TICS.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's interesting. Every year in the lab, you know, you'd get reports of people that got into hot spots. You know, I've been out turkey hunting, and I have not picked up a tick. But my grandson, who is in middle school, him and his classmates picked up 7 ticks on the playground just this week. And it's just, I mean, sometimes it's hard to explain what really is going on.
Yeah. Well, I know to send in ticks, people can request free collection kits. They also need to fill out it's just a short form about where each tick is found. And I guess that location is probably pretty important.
Yeah, it definitely, again, as you look at historical records, you can track some of these diseases, where they're, you know, place of origin and how they move, and it really, really is quite intriguing. And I will tell you professionally, that probably was the most intriguing scientific question I experienced in my career is Lyme disease and its related things and what's going on with the black-legged tick.
Yeah. If you want a prepaid collection kit, you can email. And I'm pretty sure Joel's got this up on our site, the Larry Mueller Show. But it's TICS, ticks, at marshfieldclinic.org. So TICS, as in ticks without the K, at marshfieldclinic.org. Or you can call 1-715-389-7796. You're not going to remember that, but if you go to ideas@wpr.org/Larry, you're going to find it. Is climate change bringing new species of ticks to Wisconsin?
Well, there's the potential. You know, one of the things that I witnessed in over the years is I always used to tease. In fact, I've used this line on the show before. The governor moved us to Missouri 20 years ago and didn't tell us, because a lot of southern things have moved upwards, and it really was. Critters that I could only find in central Illinois are now found on the Dells, and I have a whole list of those. And so there is this dramatic shift, and we see it with plants and everything else. It really is an interesting phenomenon. I want to mention one thing about ticks I think that might be worthwhile, though, is, you know, with the high incidence of Lyme disease we have in our deer tick or black-legged tick population, people should not send a tick in to be tested for the disease. If you know you had one of those ticks on you for more than 36 hours and you know it's the right kind of tick, you should talk to your family physician, because you should be prescribed antibiotics before you show any symptoms. And, of course, if you send ticks off to be analyzed, it takes numbers of days, and this is important to have these treatments done really shortly after you were exposed.
And in terms of prevent, you know, how do you protect yourself from ticks?
Well, you know, they talk about wearing long pants and tucking your socks, but, you know, when I go out in areas that I'm suspicious of, I have a lot of faith, and there are clothing treatments that contain the insecticide permethrin. It's a little deceptive because they say they're a tick repellent. No, they kill ticks, technically. And so if the tick walks on a treated surface, it's going to die before it gets any chance to give you any problems. And so and for people that spend a lot of time outdoors, they even sell clothes that this stuff is already impregnated in, so you don't have to spray it. But a lot of times these sprays will last 4 or 5 washings. And I think it's just a good precaution, again, if you're in an area of a lot of ticks, and especially when you're worrying more about the black-legged tick, because, as I said, that one, we really don't experience, it's very unusual to have any kind of human disease issue from our American dog tick, or what we all grew up calling a wood tick, but not so much with the deer tick / black-legged tick.
Let's take some questions. Joe in Oshkosh, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, we recently moved back to Oshkosh, But we lived in red granite for the last 5 years, right out in the woods. And we have had this beetle, I believe it's a beetle, I mean, last summer, last fall, and even all winter, and they were getting in the house. And now we moved here, and I notice I have to check every box now, every flap, because they hide in the cardboard. And well, and I'd like to know what they are. They fly, and so I think it's a beetle. They have, I believe they have 6 legs. They have long antenna. They're about 1 1/8 inches long and kind of narrow, kind of shaped like a kayak. And they're brown in color.
Okay. I'm taking a little bit of a leap here just because, you know, without a picture, there's so many things. But for something that has bothered you all winter and whatnot, not a beetle, but there's a critter that is called a western conifer seed bug. And as the name implies, it feeds on the seed of pine trees and spruce trees. But its claim to fame is it sneaks into buildings to spend the winter, like box elder bugs and Asian lady beetles. And then in the spring, they wake up and head out. And so I would suggest to look that one up. And again, you could have just been unfortunate enough to bring some boxes with you that had some of these things, quote, hibernating in, and now they're waking up. The good news is they're harmless. I mean, other than feeding on the seeds of those plants, they really don't do anything. But from your description, especially the long antennae, the general shape, the brownishness of the critter, I'm suspicious that's what it is.
Sounds like that to me as well. Joe, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Christina in Glenwood, we go to you now. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. Last summer, we got some big yellow and black wasps. They entered through the aluminum siding. They were nesting there, and ultimately, they did, in fact, get into the lower level of our home. Is there anything that I can do from preventing them, discouraging them from seeking that area to nest?
Yeah, well, you know, the good news is they don't come back and reuse nests per se. But what it tells me is they get access to your wall voids. I'm real suspicious. It could be a Polistes paper wasp, but it could be some of the yellow jackets because they both kind of fit that description. But they need a pre-existing opening. And so it really is worthwhile to just kind of take a close, slow look outside and look up. And if you see some seams or holes or other things that a wasp could get access into your walls, just plug it up. You know, now you don't plug it up once they're active and building, but this time of the year when they're searching out nests and you're just dealing with a single queen, so it's not, you know, like hundreds of critters when we get into the late summer, it's all about plugging things and keeping them out, screening, whatever it takes. And that should help out a lot. But as I said, it's not as if the offspring of this last year's population remembers where the nest is. And they purposely don't reuse the nests, we think, biologically, because that is a way of picking up diseases. So they tend to search out and start new nests every spring.
Yeah, there you go, Christina. Thank you for calling. And Don in Bayfield County, your turn. Hi, Don.
Hey. I've got a lot of dog ticks up here this reason because no snow, no cold weather, and there's ticks that are really, really, really tiny, and I'm kind of scared.
You experiencing them when you're out working in the yard or when you're out hiking, or where are you running into them?
All over my property.
Okay.
And you're in Bayfield County, so.
Yeah, this is the case. I mean, technically speaking, if this was a schoolyard that was covered with ticks, there are sprays that can be used. But that really is quite unusual to do that. And that's not practical if you've got, you know, 4 acres of woods and whatnot. Two things. For the dog tick or wood tick that we call, the season is now until about the 1st of July. The season for the deer/black-legged tick is anytime there's no snow on the ground. So, you know, I would experience or suggest to use those clothing sprays. And the other thing is when you are out and about and doing things, it may be, at least when the tick numbers are high, well worth it to change your clothes out in the garage and just leave the clothes out there. Because, you know, that's one of the problems is a lot of times when you bring the ticks in on your clothes and then they wander around the house and they're not going to breed in the house and they're not going to live for a long period of time, but you potentially get an exposure. So when I go into areas that is heavily tick infested, I generally plan to change my clothes outside the house in the garage and put something on that, that hasn't been exposed. This way that keeps the critters outside.
Yeah, that's very good idea. Don, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison. Our producer today is Joel Patenhod, and our technical director, Jeff Robbins. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR. Starting this coming Monday, as a matter of fact, this show will become 2 hours long instead of 90 minutes, and you may need to listen to it on another of our stations or in another way. And if you haven't looked it up, sort it out. Go to WPR.org/new. That's WPR.org/new for those coming changes. Let's go to Bob in Kewaunee next. Bob, hello. Thank you for calling.
Oh, good morning, gentlemen. I was curious as to the area that the cicadas cover. Will they go north along the lakeshore, or do they pretty much...
No, what I remember, you even got to get south of Milwaukee. As I said, in that southeast corner, even Lake Geneva, and what it's crazy about Lake Geneva, you drive into town, in one section of town, there's nothing. And the first time I had went down there, we were going to do a TV shoot, and I thought, oh, boy, this isn't going to work. And then it was like you hit a brick wall. And this has a lot to do, again, with land use patterns. You have to have... areas that have been historically wooded, so anything that agriculturally worked or whatnot is not going to be suitable. You're going to see a lot of press in northern Illinois out of some of the forest preserves, which is the right kind of land. And as I said, it's quite spotty. PJ does have a map up of some of the, quote, historic spots where we've seen them, and it'll give you a better idea. But as I said, along the Wisconsin River Valley to some degree, but I go into the southeast part of the state, and you can even get into some parts of Racine and not see them. I mean, it really is quite spotty. And, you know, a bigger segment of that population really is in northern Illinois than it is in Wisconsin.
There you go, Bob. You're not going to find them very – well, you won't find them in a place like Door County, for example.
Right.
You can join in, too, by the way. Number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Tim in northern Wisconsin, we'll go to you. Hi, Tim.
Hi, yes. My question is about something called tick tubes. T-U-B-E-S, that where they treat cotton with promethean that gets on the mice. Do you believe they're effective?
Tick
yes.
tubes. They are effective. Oh.
Yes. This is some of the first work that was done trying to reduce especially black-legged or deer tick populations. And since in the immature stage they concentrate on mice, and the theory was if you treated this stuff, the mice would come and steal that cotton and put it in their nests, and it did help reduce it. In fact, they were even looking at times of treating large areas, dropping these tubes from helicopters or airplanes trying to reduce it. I never really saw an experiment to make that practical, both for a cost basis or whatnot. But in small scale, backyards and whatnot, that is definitely one thing. And I haven't been keeping up if you can still buy them on the market, but it sounds like you can. And it definitely is some good science behind what they're doing.
Tick tubes. There you go. Tim, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Owen in Cornucopia emailed to ask about the periodic cicadas and how the prime numbers 13 and 17 apply to them and how it affects predation. Owen wonders if there are annual cicadas as far north as Cornucopia. We kind of answered that, but go ahead.
Yeah, well, you know, we have dog day cicadas, the one we typically talk about, that comes out in July and August.
Yeah.
And there are populations of that, so you see emergences every year. In fact, literally, I think we are at about 5 species of cicadas in the state, although some of them aren't real common, and we have them all the way throughout the whole state. So, but, you know, what the theory is that the ones that go through these 13 or 17-year cycles, you know, they come out in large numbers and whatnot, but any predator that depends on them is not going to be able to eat for a good 12 to
16 years. So, you know, that's one of the main driving theories is that this is a way to avoid predation. But in the case of our dog day cicadas, we have seen the cicada killer wasp move into the state, and it is a prime a predator of those. And I, you know, that's one of those insects that I teased about. I never saw it outside of Indiana when I started my career, and now they are established in the southern third of the state. And so they have moved upwards because of the milder winters is what the theory is.
Let's go back to Lyme disease for a minute. That's a growing health concern here, isn't it, in the state?
Well, yeah, it has been. And, you know, it's always hard to get exact figures because, you know, some people, as I said, now we're treating people before they even have positive blood tests. So you're not quite sure. But, you know, the trigger that started us in this direction of treating preventatively with antibiotics is to go out and you can test the ticks to see what percentage are carrying the disease. And, you know, when it starts running 40% of the adults or that the nymphal stage, which is younger, has half that number, anything over 20% in the adults is considered prevalent enough that CDC recommends we treat people as quick as we can after they got the exposure to the tick, if we know it was a deer tick or black-legged tick. And everything indicates the numbers just keep going up and up and up. And then again, you know, why Marshfield is looking at this, as we have looked into it, there are definitely other organisms that people are picking up, anaplasmosis, ehrlichiosis. There is another type of Lyme disease that's associated with mice that doesn't seem to be quite as dramatic in people, but they still get it. And so, as I said, there are a number of things. What's always been interesting to me is that our wood tick is so inefficient in comparison with the black-legged tick as far as vectoring these diseases. And they both feed on rodents and whatnot, but, you know, nobody's been able to get transmission out of wood ticks. If they feed on an infected rodent, they can't give it to the next animal, which is really quite interesting.
It is indeed. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Let's turn our attention to tent caterpillars for a minute, Phil. You know, those silky tents that of the eastern tent caterpillar are starting to appear in trees, I guess. How damaged?
Yeah, although, you know, my take, I've been curious. I have yet to see a tent. And we're getting far enough along that they should start to become quite visible. And so, you know, their populations ebb and flow. But, you know, people often confuse it for spongy moth, which it's not. It's basically a one generation in the spring on flowering fruit trees. The caterpillars live in that protected environment during a good part of the day, and then they'll go out and forage at night. So as I said, if things don't turn around the next week, I'm going to just predict it is just a very low number. Now, I don't get around the whole state. It could be other places, but May is always the time that you worry about it. And, you know, if it's your flowering crabapple in your yard, you know, the quicker you get at the tent, you can even hand crush them. They're so much easier to deal with when they're small. And it pretty much correlates that the eggs hatch about the time the tree just starts to leaf out. So, as I said, we're getting far enough along that it should be more visible if they're there.
Yeah, absolutely. And they don't really kill the trees, or typically, I don't think.
No, in fact, the tree will leaf out again, you know, which is really quite fascinating. Now, the trouble with spongy moth is it feeds on oaks and it repeatedly goes after things and can cause enough stress that the tree gets in trouble. But tent caterpillar is really, you argued, cosmetic. And so when they're out there feeding on, the wild cherries out in the woodlots and whatnot, it's just nothing to worry about. And for those trees that are even 100% stripped, if you make mark down somewhere and come back in 2 or 3 weeks, you'll see they'll leafed out again.
Oh, very interesting. And you can, if you've got one in your single cherry tree or whatever, you can take it off. I assume just take the small tents off Maybe
you can clip them out. You can crush them in newspaper. You can spray them with soapy water. Now, when they start getting bigger, they're harder to kill too. You can consider sprays. There are some organic sprays, the bacterial insecticides and whatnot. So people got a lot of options. But you know, if there's a couple tents up in a 30-foot cherry tree, don't bother.
Don't bother. D in Erin, Wisconsin. We'll turn to you now. Hi, D.
Hi, Larry and Phil. Thank you for this show. I always enjoy both of you. So my question is, if there's something that can keep the deer ticks off of my dogs, they're treated so they won't get Lyme disease, but they bring them in the house, and my husband's already had Lyme disease twice. So is there some preventative to keep them off of the dogs?
Well, you know, there are on animal treatments, but as you've been doing, the treatments that you give your dog for their own protection both last longer in the like. It would be a possibility to spray the dog with, again, permethrin-type sprays. There are some products registered for that that would kill the ticks, but, boy, it's an awful lot of bother. And so, as I said, usually I think give the dog their protection with whether you buy stuff from the vet or the like, and then just kind of keep your guard up. It's interesting because some of these ticks are just kind of hitchhiking, and the male ticks in particular, honestly, and especially in the adult stage, are a bit of a less concern as far as disease transmission because their purpose really is more to find a mate than it is to feed on blood.
Yeah, interesting. Well, and when the what you get from the vet, does that say you inject the dog?
When the tick feeds, it's going to die.
Okay.
It's not a contact kill. Now, unlike mosquitoes, where one would bite you, Larry, and then if we disturbed it, can come bite me. Ticks don't seem to work that way. They have a much longer process to feed, and so they're not running back and forth as much, in fact, at all. So you really don't worry about that part. But as the listener had mentioned, a dog can pick one up, and it's kind of hitchhiking, and before it gets a chance to feed, it drops off, and all of a sudden now you got a tick crawling in your house. And there is a tick called a brown dog tick that is capable of breeding indoors. It is not found outdoors in Wisconsin. It's kind of more of a southwestern U.S. and whatnot. So I don't worry about that. Once in a great while, we would see specimens that people picked up when they kennel their dogs, because the ticks could breed in the kennels. But as I said, that really is not an important factor in Wisconsin.
Just to alert you, Joel sent me a photo of a caterpillar for you to identify, and I believe he emailed it to you as well. But in the meantime, Roger in Grantsburg, we'll give you a chance to join in. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. How are you doing? Thanks for making me itchy. I'm out here. I got my back scratcher standing by my truck, and I'm scratching because, ticks. It's like, oh, man, As soon as you find one, you're like itchy all day. But my question is, it seems like, I'm up here in northwestern Wisconsin, Grantsburg, and it seemed like as soon as we didn't have very much snow this winter, and my dog, Charlie, he's out running around pretty soon. I'm like, what the heck you got on you? He's here, it's like the end of February, and he picked up a tick. And it was like it was more nice. We had some nice weeks there where the weather was pretty decent. And what are they evolving to where as soon as the snow is gone, they're active?
Yeah.
I mean, that definitely is the case with deer ticks. If there's no snow on the ground, it's 40 degrees, they're active. So I had that tick coming in January in the lab, historically, if the weather conditions were right. You just got to keep your guard up because, as I said, it's ticks are cold-blooded like insects. And so below 40 degrees, they can't move. But, boy, you get a south slope in a good sun, it gets warm enough that they are up, and as soon as they're starting to move, they're looking for something to feed on. So, yes, you got to be careful. And as I said, usually the, quote, wood tick season is done by the 1st of July because we're only dealing with adult ticks. But with the case of deer tick, black-legged tick, there is life stages out there all the time. And so, if you're a person that gets out in an area with a lot of ticks, you got to stay protected all the time. There is no tick season other than, again, snow and no snow is all that I use.
Roger, thanks again for calling. Appreciate it. Let's turn to Bob in Madison next. Hi, Bob.
Yes, for this permethrin for the tick, they have the permethrin that's like marketed for humans, like you can buy at REI, and it's really expensive. And then they have like stuff that's marketed to farm animals and such. And it's usually high concentrated and considerably cheaper. And it's just like really hard to get information as to whether this farm stuff can is appropriate or not. I mean, there's like the online stuff isn't very good as far as I can tell. And I have used the farm stuff, but it kind of stinks. And I'm just wondering, the Sawyer stuff, the stuff from REI is extremely expensive. I mean, I think it's like $30 for two or three shirts.
Yeah.
Boy, you should be able to get less. So the concern isn't so much two things. The active ingredient, you got to look at concentration, because if you start kicking the concentration up, then you get more concerned about human reactions of rashes and the like. But even more importantly, it's the carriers. When they formulate the stuff, they're putting special things on the clothing stuff so that it stays on the clothing and the like, which my concern on farm animals, they might be using other types of products to do the intended purpose. Now, it should be quite, if you look around, because I know the Sawyer product, at least the stuff that I have seen for on clothing spray. Now, this is not to put through the wash, but to take the clothes, spray them, let them dry, and then, as I had mentioned, you can usually go through three or four washings before that you have to worry about reapplying. Hasn't been quite that pricey. I mean, I could think I could do all my hunting clothes about four times over with the one thing of Sawyer's that I had purchased. But it is, you know, this discussion, people can even get a more concentrated form of this that they used to use for termites. And again, my concern was, wow, the dosage is way too much. And secondly, what you're trying to do with termites with carriers is so much different. And so, as I said, that's where, you know, aside from making the argument, it's not labeled for that use. There are some reasons behind it why I would be real cautious with using something that's not labeled.
Yeah, there you go, Bob. Thanks very much for calling. Yeah, I've used that spray. You can buy a can of it and spray it on your clothes. And one can goes a pretty long ways.
Yeah, I think what he might have been looking at, you know, I do know that they do sell some special stuff that you can put in the washing machine, or you put it in a barrel with water and wash the clothes. And then it maybe could get quite pricey, I could see. And so there probably are some formulations out there that, you know, make your eyes roll when you try to think, when you see other stuff that is, you know, a tenth the cost.
Did you have a chance to look at that email photo of a small caterpillar that Joanne emailed us?
Yeah, so my first take on it, because it isn't totally clear, it's definitely the caterpillar of a butterfly, one of the nymphalids, but I can't tell which one. And it's got all these crazy little spines on the back, which makes it look kind of scary. If she still has a picture, it'd be worth going on a site like Wisconsin Butterflies and look under the brushwood of butterflies and just kind of scroll through, and she maybe sees a better match. What we use, you know, there are some color patterns that I can't quite make out on the special picture she gave me that would identify to the species. But, anything from red admirals to some of those other ones, they're all pretty typical look like that. So it's definitely a butterfly caterpillar, and it's just a question of which species.
Let's go to Mary in Sugar Island next. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I'm wondering about bumblebees. I really have some big, big bumblebees around here. I rescued one that got on the porch screen and so on, and I don't want to harm them. But boy, I don't like them buzzing around me. And even in the evening by the basement when it's quite dark, they're buzzing around, so I don't know if they have a place that they go back there at night or what.
Yeah, I'd be a little suspicious that you might have a queen that's found a hole or something to set up a nest. You know, the way bumblebees work is they overwinter as queens, and in the spring of the year they find an old rodent burrow or a rock wall with a hole in it, and that's where they set up their nest and go out and get pollen and lay eggs. And, you know, a bumblebee colony never gets big like a honeybee colony or paper wasp. And generally speaking, they're much milder mannered. I mean, it's really hard to get them aggravated. Now, if you disturb the nest, like anything, they get quite defensive. So what it might be worth is just kind of sitting there quietly and watch to see if it's going a hole in the ground or something, and then you can deal with it. And in one of the arguments this early in the season is, you know, you really can't relocate nests. But if you see them starting a nest somewhere and you plug it so they can't get in, they'll go find someplace else to raise their young down the road. And so May really is a good time to deal with bumblebees. And if you see a place that they seem to be very enamored with, that is some kind of hole or cavity, those are the things that you would, if it's close to the house, you'd want to see if you can convince them to go someplace else.
Yeah. Mary, thanks for calling. Zach and Delavan, your turn. Hi, Zach.
Hey, guys. I'm a bumblebee brigade volunteer. I go out and do surveys for our bumblebee species, and I'm curious. I don't like to wear, you know, on any pyrethrins because from what I've heard, that is damaging, you know, to multiple kinds of insects. But obviously, mm-hmm. I want tick protection. Is DEET still maybe the best choice, or, you know, is there a good balance there between DEET and the pyrethrins?
Sure. So it turns out that DEET is a repellent, not a quote, killer. And so the argument there is DEET you typically don't put so much on your clothes, but you put it on your skin. And if you don't treat a 4-square-inch area on your back, that they can still find it and feed. So it is quite effective. But side-by-side, permethrin is more effective because the argument is if the tick walks on the treated clothing, it's going to die because of the reaction. The other side of it, though, is, you know, if you sprayed any kind of bumblebee with permethrin, that is, you know, it's done. But if you have clothing that is treated and the stuff is dried, I can't see how they're going to get enough exposure that there's any problem. Within reason. Again, if you had a pair of gloves that had been absolutely soaked in the stuff and you were wearing those gloves when you're dealing with, that would not be a good choice. But, a proper treatment of pant legs and whatnot, I just can't see the exposure as long as the stuff's dry. If it's wet, when you first put it on, that's where there is much better chance of getting a non-target exposure.
Yeah, there you go, Zach. And with sort of a related here, Charlie in Milwaukee wondered if using flea and tick collars folded in the cuffs of your jeans, will that help keep ticks away?
That's an old home remedy. And again, I there are different products and different flea and tick collars, and so I really can't answer it straightforward. And again, to me, use the stuff you know that worked that's labeled for it rather than experiment with this other stuff. And I do know that there are some formulations of tick collars that would not work. So as I said, I think you're really taking a risk, even though that's something that's been discussed for 20 years.
Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, entomologist and a distinguished faculty associate emeritus of UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR. Taking a look at the world of insects here in Wisconsin, Larry Mueller here with my guest, Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus of UW-Madison. Questions, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. And see, we have some more photos. If you have a photo you want to have Phil take a crack at identifying, you can send it in the same way. Send that photo to talk@WPR.org. Perry and Oconto, will go to you now. Thank you for calling.
Yes, I have a question about ants, but I just want to make a comment on the ticks. One thing, I believe that permethrin lasts for several weeks, I think like 6 weeks or more. I usually don't wash my clothes in between washings. They're just for outside clothes. And having some type of gaiter or knee boots helps because the ticks usually go up. And so it keeps them from going down and getting in your pant leg. But my question is about ants. And Phil, this is what I've had going on. I've had some ants around the kitchen sink, and they were proliferating themselves, And so I put out some borax and sugar and borax mixed with peanut butter. The first day they went crazy for the peanut butter borax mix, and they were pretty much wiped out. But then I had them come back about a week later. They ignored the peanut butter completely, but they went for the borax sugar, and I haven't seen them now for several days. Is that a good way to kill them? And also, if you have them in the yard, is that diatomaceous earth on their little mounds, is that helpful?
Okay. The diatomaceous earth, no. If you had an ant in a jar with diatomaceous earth, it's dead, but it just does not penetrate into the soil and do the abrasive stuff that it does in that environment. You know, when we it sounds like you did your homework on the ants. Basically, they're sugar feeders or fat and protein feeders. And when you try to match the bait, that's the biggest mistake people make is if you don't give them choices and you make the wrong choice, it doesn't work. Now, technically, if they accept the bait and they take enough of it back and particularly feed the queen, she's the only member that can breed in the population, and so that you shut the colony down. What I'm a little perplexed, there's some ants that feed on both. And so I don't know if you have two different species of ants that explains the difference, or you've got one species that they don't learn per se, but insects do some interesting interactions as far as avoiding things. In fact, with carpenter ants, which is kind of on the high scale of ants, we found with baits, if they kill the ants too quickly, the queen never got fed. It's kind of like, you know, when you talk about people that would eat food for the king to make sure it wasn't poisoned. Well, the ants, the queen is so valuable. And so slow-working poisons often were better. And boric acid is a slow-working poison when it's eaten as a stomach poison. So the big question as far as ultimate success is, did you get enough boric acid into the colony to wipe it out? Or did you just give it enough to knock it down and now it's resurfacing? And that's a hard one to answer, other than it's encouraging that you got a lot of activity and then it shut down. That usually is a sign of success.
Kathy in Sauk County emailed a photo of a beetle. I don't know if you saw it yet.
Mm-hmm.
She wants to know, is it a problem species?
Okay. Critter is called a pine sawyer, S-A-W-Y-E-R. It's a type of long-horned wood-boring beetle, or we call cerambycids. This one's found on dead pine and spruce. It also occasionally comes out of new log homes if they had recycled some of the or the beetles infested the logs when they were cut. It's harmless. They only attack dead and dying trees, and they can't reinfest wood, so it's not like powder post beetle, but they're big and kind of scary looking, and they're really very similar to the Asian longhorn beetle that eats maple trees, but that one has not been found in Wisconsin. In fact, I have not heard a lot about that critter in recent years. It's one of those things, though, if you looked at a picture on the internet, you could, it's similar enough that if you didn't do a little more homework, you could be deceived. But these pine sawyers, they get the name because you can literally hear them in the trees. And aside from sawdust coming out, it sounds like something's chewing or grinding on it. You know, I've had that same experience in brand new log homes, which is not so pleasant. But other than that, it's one of the bigger and showier insects in the state.
Jane in Duluth, Minnesota. It's your turn. Thanks for calling, Jane.
Yes, I'd just like to pass some help to dog and cat owners. And I'm not getting paid for this, but I've done rescue. I've bred dogs for years. I've gone through terrible tick problems over the years. And I finally, I tried everything, especially where you have to cut something and pull liquid over their back. Seresto collars, which are in a round tin, they sell them at all the farm and tractor places. It's Seresto, S-E-R-E, Resto. And you just put this collar on, cut it off to the size of the dog. And this is the first time in years. I haven't had a tick, more than two ticks, and they were already dying on my dog's fur. And I have two dogs.
Oh, Seresto collars. I've heard those recommended before on the show, Phil.
Yeah, and without looking at the product to see what the active ingredient, I'm a little bit of a loss. But again, if something's registered for that use and it does have the contact kill, again, I some of the veterinary products are not technically sold as insecticides, and so again, entomologists don't get a lot of exposure to how they work. It doesn't surprise me that you know there are some really effective products that are available as on pet treatments.
Yeah.
And in some cases, even fed to pets, in other cases, injected. I mean, they've got all kinds of ways to try to protect your animal.
Yeah, thanks, Jane. Appreciate that reminder about Seresto collars. Jim in Hudson, we'll go to you now. Hi, Jim.
Yes, good morning.
Morning.
I've got a kind of an unimportant question, but it's a curiosity question. Now, first of all, in passing, I'll mention that I took Entomology 101 back in 1969 over at the university and right across from the ice cream shop, and that's instilled in me an interest in insects for my entire life.
Did you take it from Bob Dick?
I remember? Don't remember the name of the professor, but we had at the time we had a visiting professor from England, and he pronounced the word moth. Muff. Anyway, he was pretty good. So I've got fond memories of that. Anyway, so I'm in Hudson, Wisconsin. I'm sitting on my deck, and I noticed this a couple of times just yesterday. There are these insects, and I actually captured a few of them, and I looked at them, and I think they're midges. They're very much like mosquitoes, except they have bushy antennae. And otherwise, in many respects, they're very much the same size and everything as mosquitoes. And are they midges? But they're swirling around in a almost like there's in a column of air moving up and down there. They're kind of moving up and down, almost like there's a little vortex there. Why do these insects do that? And first of all, how do they even have the sense to do that?
Sure.
And there's like 50 or 100 of them out there. They're swirling around. Isn't that odd? But
these critters, that's a common behavior. So I think you have a form of lake fly. We call them chironomids, and there are literally dozens of species of lake flies in this state, small ones, middle, and the big. And you're experiencing a mating swarm. And so those clouds are males. And they often use geographic markers. You know, you'll find 2 feet above a garbage can. Why? I don't know, but it's a kind of a visual thing. And the whole idea is these mating swarms are going on, and the females come in, pick a mate, and go out. So back in the day, you know, a professor used to tease about them being single bars. Well, that may be a weird exaggeration, but it's definitely a mating phenomena. And you can use it. Certain light patterns cause it, so maybe you just see them in the afternoon between 4 and 6, and then you come back the next day, and they're there, but you come at 2 in the afternoon, they're not there yet. So it's very interesting sides. And you can get tremendous emergences, but the whole thing about lake flies is they're aquatic in the maggot stage. So they have to come from water of some sort, ponds in particular, lakes. Not as common in streams. They're more of a stagnant or pond water type of critter, but very common. And one of the reasons that fish do well in these lakes is because they make great fish food.
Yeah, absolutely. Jim, thank you so much for calling. Chloe in Madison emailed a photo of a moth Chloe found by Lake Superior this summer. And so, you know that moth?
The moth is called the white lion sphinx moth. It is the caterpillar stage is a type of hornworm, which all the sphinx moths are. And this one it flies during the day, and it often is called a hummingbird moth. Because their behavior, they're kind of a small for a hummingbird, but not that small. And when you see them, the way they skirt between flowers, you would think. She also sent some other things. She has some pictures of these lake flies. At least that's what I'm guessing on the screens. She had mentioned again how mm-hmm. they are mosquito-like in appearance. The phenomena is you can get an emergence very quickly, large numbers for a week or two, and then they disappear. And, of course, the Lake Winnebago lake fly is infamous in the history of our state.
And Kay emailed photos of the leaves on their cranberry bush. They believe the leaves are being fed on by viburnum leaf borers.
Now, viburnum leaf beetle, which is a relatively new introduction. I remember the first intercepts when I was still running the lab. They were eliminated in west of Madison. But then just shortly when I was retiring, They started showing up in Milwaukee and elsewhere, and I know from chatting with PJ, they are very widespread. The thing about that critter is it lays its eggs to get through the winter. The eggs hatch when it's starting to leaf out, and so if you're going to protect your plants, that's when you do it. You shut the door when the leaves are, you know, maybe a half to three-quarters of an inch long, and spray, and then you'll have the most effect. You won't have the damage, and they won't have the population to lay the eggs in the future. We're getting late enough quite now that, you know, fine, you can protect further leaves from being eaten, but I'm not so sure that they're going to go along pretty quickly. The larvae are little warty-looking worm-like creatures, and the adult is a type of leaf beetle we have lots of different leaf beetles, but they're host specific. They only feed on viburnum. That's a giveaway. In fact, that damage is so characteristic, you don't even have to know the insect. You see what it looks like, and you know it's viburnum leaf beetle.
Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, and he's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today to take your insect questions. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. And if you want to send a photo, we can see what we can do about identifying it as well. We'll take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on WPR, and then we'll be back. I'm Larry Mueller. Taking a look at the world of insects on the show today with our guest, Phil Pelletieri, entomologist. He retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab in 2014. Comes by regularly to talk about insects. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining in. If you have a question, you can join in at 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And if you've got a photo, use that email address. Jill emailed to say they'll be running a summer day camp. Kids are already picking up ticks in the grass near a playground. And Jill says they have some hikes planned in wooded and tall grass areas. Any suggestions? They have 10 to 20 kids aged 6 to 11.
Boy, we get into this issue about parents and how comfortable they are with treating. I think part of the direction I would go is to try to educate parents, both if they're more comfortable with treating their kids' clothes or give them a pair of clothes that have been treated for their hikes. Or, again, you know, because that's a personal decision, but at least make people aware that after they go on their hikes and whatnot, to do tick checks, you know, to just kind of look and see. And, I know at times when things have gotten bad enough that people automatically wash clothing after use because the ticks will not survive the washing machine would be a possibility. In fact, you would even argue sometimes you can put stuff just in the dryer because the kind of temperature that's generated there, the ticks won't survive. But I think it's kind of, there are no guarantees, but I think everybody's got to keep walking into this with their eyes wide open about the potential. And again, the tick season will start to subside as we get later on, at least with the wood tick season. But right now, as I said, I'm getting a couple reports that I really don't even quite understand how to explain why we're getting so many ticks in areas that you wouldn't expect to see them thrive. You know, mowed lawns is not a good habitat for ticks. It's that interface between where your lawn has stopped getting mowed and the grass gets tall and the shrubbery comes up because the moisture levels are higher, and that's important for ticks. They don't do well in dry environments, but in moist environments, they're much happier.
Ivy emailed to ask for advice on reducing an infestation of Asian lady beetles. They've been repainting and caulking interior cracks and crevices, but feels hopeless. I'm wondering if mums or light traps would help, Ivy is, or spraying outside in the fall.
Yeah, probably the fall. Light traps, if you have a light trap in your house, they've already gotten in and they're coming out of the attic, so that doesn't get you. And they're really not that strongly attracted to light, other than if there's only a light source and no other light, they might go to it. The first argument is when you're painting and whatnot, you seal everything you can. Look to make sure all your vents are screened with small enough mesh screen they can't get through. But in old farmhouses and whatnot, where there's just so many leaky places, and if they've become really problematic, the time of the year to treat this is probably beginning of October. What seems to be the trigger that makes the Asian lady beetles come in is the first moderate freeze, and then you get the warm 60, 70 degree days, and it's like you turn a light on. It's just amazing how quickly they start coming in, and you have to have your defense up before that. And so, as I said, I usually find end of September, well into October is the time. The sunny sides of the house are the most important, although where they're most attractive is the interface between where the sun is and where it's shady. In natural settings, they're attracted to cliff faces and whatnot where they get under the rock crevices. And, you can have the same house, one that's in the middle of the woods that never sees the sun, and one that's in the exposed, sitting up on a nice bluff and beautiful view, and the one on the nice bluff just gets inundated, and the people that are out in the woods, they don't know what you're talking about when you say you got Asian lady beetles. And so you start to think about that and look at where the most exposure, southern exposure, I would probably be the most concerned about, but and least likely on the north just because there's less light there.
Ben in Taylor's Falls, Minnesota has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Ben.
Hi. I cut a lot of firewood in the spring and fall, and I've noticed sometimes when I split folk firewood, there's these large black ants with, they seem to have wings on them, but they don't fly. What are those things?
Those are carpenter ants. And the wing forms are the reproductives, the males or the queens. And typically, ants go through a swarming process where they all come out at once. And for carpenter ants, it's often the end of May and beginning of June. But those reproductives, the wing forms, are still there before that. Now, the good news is they don't, they attack. You probably already see that the wood is somewhat compromised or there's a pre-existing hollow space. Carpenter ants don't eat wood. They nest in rotting wood. And then they can make the hole bigger. So, dead trees have rotting wood in, so that's not surprising. But it's a nuisance. I have people that store a lot of firewood in their basement, and they were not aware that there were carpenter ant nests in there. And then all of a sudden you got those in, and there's other critters that come out of dead wood too. So, more of a curiosity, nothing to worry about. Carpenter ants are found on every property in the state, usually in dead and dying trees and stumps, that kind of thing. But if you got a bad windowsill, they move into windowsill, and that's where people misrepresent what's going on. They blame the ants for ruining the windowsill. The windowsill was rotting, and the ants moved in is what's going on.
Pat in Rhinelander has a question for you. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Okay, there's a business coming around in the area here up in the Northwoods where they're called the Mosquito Police, and they say they fog your all around, and they say that they only kill mosquitoes and ticks, and I want to know if that's really true.
No. I mean, you can play around with doses of insecticide to be somewhat more selective, but it's more widespread than that. And in the case of ticks, because they have a two-year life cycle, one spray in a place that's problematic will give you a year's worth of control, no problem, because they just can't reproduce quick enough. The argument with mosquitoes is all you're doing is killing the mosquitoes that are in your property now, and once the stuff starts to break down, more mosquitoes can blow in with the wind. And it has been shown that if you repeatedly use the same insecticides in these environments, you cause all kinds of upsets. You get spider mites and other things. And so, I'm very much sympathetic. You're going to have a backyard wedding. You need to make sure there's no mosquitoes. Very appropriate to come out and spray the yard and knock the things down a couple days before the guests come. That's fine. But to repeat throw insecticides out in the environment, if they have long enough residual to kill the insects the way they should, then you're going to kill a whole bunch of other stuff that you don't want to kill.
All right. Pat, thank you for calling. And Todd in Madison, your turn. Hi, Todd.
Hello. Well, the summer's almost here, and the hex flies on the creek for trout fishing on Black Earth Creek. And it seems like in years past, there was a lot more. And I'm just wondering if that's just me or if the number seems to be down.
Boy, you know, without knowing somebody that's monitoring the stream on a regular basis, you do see, you know, good years and bad years. I had a professor, Dr. Bill Hilsenhoff, who taught a course in aquatic entomology, and he was one of the first people that would use what insects are found in streams to tell you how good the water quality is. And the basic thing is when you start to get too much pollution and other things and the oxygen levels change, things like hex flies disappear. So, you know, it's hard for me to say, you know, one observation, year's observation isn't enough. It makes you nervous when you start to see things that you're used to seeing, not seeing them. It could be related to either things in the water or water temperature. Because, again, what you find is as you're raising the temperature, you start to get in temperatures that are not as good for some of these clean water stream-type insects, you know, like the stoneflies and the mayflies and the like.
Bill emailed to say they've read that if you wrap your pants legs with duct tape backwards, the sticky side out, when they start the ticks start climbing up your ankles, they'll get stuck on the duct tape. What do you think?
I think there is some level of protection. What you worry about is when you're brushing through the raspberry patch and the ticks that are on the higher parts of the stuff, what waist level get on your person and they're not protected. So, you know, ticks are all about sitting on grass, shrubbery, and other things and waiting for you to brush by, whether it's a dog or a person. And so not everything starts from that low. And as I said, if you're getting in waist-high weeds, the ticks could be right at the top of that, and you're picking them up at waist high.
You can join in, too, 800-642-1234, the number to call. Email to talk@WPR.org. Terry in Milwaukee, what's on your mind?
Yeah, hi. I have these scarlet lily beetles on my true lilies, and they're eating holes in the leaves, and they're really quite unsightly, these little sluggy, immature things. How do I get rid of them safely without killing my friends, the bees?
Yeah, you can try soapy water sprays because those kill on contact. This lily leaf beetle is a relatively new introduction again to the state in the last 15 years or so, and it's becoming very widespread. You might notice that some lilies are more prone to it than some varieties. Another product that is pretty reasonable, there's a product that contains spinosad, which is an organic insecticide. It's pretty good at killing larval insects, and as long as you don't spray it on the bees when they're there, it shouldn't be a problem. So there are a couple options of what you can use for leaf protection without causing problems. Where it gets more ticklish is when the plants are flowering, because then you're attracting bees there. And it's hard to, you know, the soaps are okay, but some of these other things, they're hard to really find something that's selective enough that won't pose at least some risk to the bees that are working flowers.
There you go, Terry. Thank you for calling. Cheryl in Superior emailed to say they've treated their dogs with a spray, 8 ounces of water, 20 drops of citronella, lavender, and peppermint. They say it works pretty well repelling ticks. She also
the citronella, I would think, has some repellency to it. The other products, I'm not quite as sure. And the question is, how long does it last? You know, and that's, as I said, you know, things that are formulated for these treatments, they have tried to do the experiments to see how long they last, and it give you some guidance how often you have to reapply, just because, again, these things do peter out. In most of the cases, it works more as a repellent, not as a killing agent. And so, as I said, there are some natural products, but there are also sometimes, especially if you're relying on the internet or whatnot for some of the information, there are things out there that really don't work.
She was also bitten by, she says, a deer tick, but I'm not sure. But after pulling it off, it left a purple spot about the size of a pencil eraser. Area was swollen, felt like they had been pinched hard. Said it applied a poultice to the spot with lavender, onion, and dry sage leaves, and it reduced the pain and swelling. But I'd be worried if it was a deer tick, actually.
Right.
And the bite sounds deer tick-ish because the deer tick has a much more pronounced mouth part that's literally barbed. And when they feed on you, they literally glue the darn thing in. And so they're extremely difficult to get out. They go much deeper than wood ticks is feeding, and so you often get more of a reaction. And that's how I would describe it, is that somebody took a pencil and poked you real deep with it. That's a common reaction. And again, it just, you know, when this was first starting and Lyme disease was not very frequent, you kind of waited till you showed the rash or showed symptoms of it. But now, because it is so prevalent and so high in the tick population around here, if you know it's a deer tick, you call the family physician, you get one day's treatment of antibiotic, and you catch it before it gets a chance to spread throughout your body. Because once it spreads throughout your body, it is much more difficult to get people turned around and going the right way.
So if Cheryl hasn't seen her physician, she probably should.
Yeah, usually, you know, we're talking within 3 to 4 days of the tick bite, you know, and most physicians are well aware of, again, the guidelines. And they said, I mean, these guidelines go back now a good 12, 15 years, the way things have been transpiring. And so, and in fact, I even know in some cases, physicians for people, loggers or whatnot that are out there all the time and getting exposure, sometimes give people, you know, 2 or 3 doses of antibiotic that they can keep with them. So if they get an exposure, they've got the stuff to treat right there.
Mark in Sussex will go to you next. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thank you very much. You get a great show as usual.
Thank you.
The Seresto collars, that's a damned if you do and damned if you don't with those things. I've used them. They worked fantastic. My dog went deaf at 10 years old and developed a large tumor. Now, it really did work well, but I would caution you on keeping those on all the time. And some other collars, I think it was Hartz had a collar. They had a bunch of lawsuits. This was like 10 or 20 years ago. So for what it's worth.
Yeah. Thank you for calling. Comment, Phil?
Well, yeah, I mean, you do have to keep up. And this, again, when you start using things, not this product, but some other ones where people are talking, using dog collars on people, you know, you're getting into some areas that you really have got no protection in. You know, they're constantly looking at these things, and if people find problems, they take them off the market. And so, as I said, it's well to keep up with it and well to chat with your vet. Because, like I said, I do know the vets have got a lot more options than just topical sprays and collars that can be given to animals.
Annie emailed to remind that permethrin is highly toxic to cats. And also,
and fish.
I'm sorry?
And fish.
And fish.
Yes, yeah. You know, this is insecticides have personalities, and you know, who would predict? You know, you can use it on some animals, and then you find things that and permethrin is basically a synthetic version of pyrethrin, which is found in chrysanthemums. And so, even though the writing is small, there's a good reason to read the labels, because these things are spelled out explicitly for these products. And as I said, you wouldn't know it without reading it, but it does get important. And those are the two things, cats and fish in general. So you keep it away from ponds and goldfish bowls and that kind of stuff.
Lupe in Milwaukee, we'll go to you now. Hi, Lupe.
Hello. I have a question for Mr. Pelletieri.
Okay.
And has to do with the viburnum. You spoke about it earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And I had one. It was beautiful. I enjoyed the flowers, the berries, and the autumn foliage was just beautiful. And it died. It was attacked by those worms that you talked about. I want to know if I can plant another one. Now that I know what I can do to save them. Can I plant another one in the same site where the old one died?
Yes, but the other thing to pay attention to, I usually don't expect just the leaf feeding to kill the plants. When somebody tells me their viburnum died, there is a borer. It's a type of, in this case, a caterpillar that burrows into the woody part and kills them. And different viburnums have different sensitivities. I have some Korean spice on my property that don't get them at all. That's one reason I picked that particular, whereas American high-bush cranberry gets it quite a bit. But even with that said, there are cases where the leaf feeding can be enough of a stress and other things get after them, it would be a problem. But I don't think there's any problem with planting the exact same species if you really like that bush. But again, you're going to have to be pretty aggressive in the spring and knock them down before they get a chance to do too much damage.
Yeah. Thanks, Lupe. Appreciate the call. Mike in Madison, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Good afternoon. I'd like to go a little further into the pyrethrin talk. As you just mentioned, it's bad for cats and it's bad for aquatic creatures. I use it a lot. I'm an avid hunter and hiker. I use it on my boots, pants, outer shirts, and I use the hunting grade, which is like a 0.1%. I also use the farm grade, which is an 18% on like the car cover seats to keep, because dog just brings in so many ticks and other things. Could you tell me a little bit? Obviously, it says on the bottle certain precautions. Maybe you can go a little further into what I should be aware of. If it's dry and on my boots, is it still safe for me to walk through a small stream or through a wetland area, or should I be avoiding that once it's dry in the boots?
Yeah.
Again, when you get stuff that is registered for clothing, it usually sticks and it doesn't go. What is hard for me to answer for you is when you're using something that's not labeled for a purpose, like the 18%, if you had that on something, I still can't see that you would have enough concentration to cause fish kills with it. But if you spilled the bottle of the 18% in a situation like that, then the levels can get high enough. What it does in fish is it prevents them from breathing properly, and that's where they get in trouble. So, you know, again, I'm the letter of the law is the product has to be labeled for the use, and anytime you go off label, you're taking risks aside from not having the kind of background to make a good decision in some cases. But yeah, that being said, I can't see anything that you're doing is going to be a problem as far as walking through a stream.
Mike, thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. And Lisa and Viola, do you have a quick question?
Yeah, I had a rosebush that got the curly rose sawflies on it, and they have multiple hatchings a year, and there were so many I couldn't keep up with it. Like one day I picked 300 of those suckers off of it, the little slugs. So I finally gave up on the rose. I pulled it out this spring hoping that if there's nothing for when they hatch out of the ground, if there's nothing for them to eat, hoping that they will die. So my question is, A, is that going to help or will that work? And B, I have a rugosa rose maybe 100, 150 feet away, and can they fly that far and eat that thing up?
They can fly, but I'm not familiar with the species enough to know. You do see differences in different rose cultivars of what gets critters and what doesn't. What I worry about more than anything else, you know, aside from what you've got, do your neighbors have roses that are infested? Sawflies, the adult stage is a wing critter that is a pretty reasonable flyer. And this is the sawfly season. I just got done battling them on my mugo pine. It's a different species. They attack my azaleas. As soon as my azaleas leaf out, I have to offer them protection or I've got no leaves left on them. Sawflies are kind of a spring critter. But again, if you're somewhat aware of, you know, you knock the first one down, you may get lucky enough, even if they're multiple generations, and most aren't, but the ones that are, that you don't have enough to get you the second wave. But if you let things go too far, you don't catch up for that year.
You're out of luck. Phil, thank you so much. Look forward to your next visit. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Thank you so much for listening. Our book club book, The Restaurant Inspector, is for tomorrow. I'm Larry Mueller.